All right, I've been given the honor of introducing your speakers. They are Dr. Rick Kirschner and Dr. Rick Brinkman, often known as the Doctors Rick. They have co-authored four books together. The one that's most famous is called Dealing with People You Can't Stand. How to Bring Out the Best in People at Their Worst. It's in 20 languages. They follow that up with Life by Design, Bringing Out the Best in Yourself, Dealing with Relatives, How to Bring Out the Best in Family, and Love Thy Customer. They have been featured on CNN, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. Their clients have included the astronauts at NASA, Lucasfilm, FBI. Please join me in giving a warm welcome for the Doctors Rick. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. We were downsized. What can we say? More with less. How many people here have a person in their life they can't stand? Say yeah. How many of you think of two people that you can't stand? Yeah, how many people here are the person people can't stand? Everybody, somebody's problem now and again, even us on occasion.
So, you know, who are the people that people can't stand? Well, they're the people that do what you don't want them to do and don't do what you want them to do and you don't know what to do. Does that sound about right? We're talking about the pushy people, the negative people, the disruptive, wishy-washy, and vague people, the distracting people, the explosive people that are a normal course of modern living. Now, we've been asked why... still not there. We've been asked what... I'm not actually stalling. We're in the program now. We've been asked why the problem of problem people hasn't gone away. And the answer is a pretty simple one. We are creatures of habit, us human beings. How many of you would like the world to calm down? Wouldn't that be great? And have you noticed that instead of calming down, it's doing the exact opposite? And the fact of the matter is that when people are faced with a lot of change, they've got two choices. We've got two choices. You've got two choices. One is to adapt, to be flexible and be resourceful, to embrace the change as a normal part of life and find the leverage that it gives us to make tomorrow different than today, because when everything's changing, there's more opportunity to do things than when everything is kind of stable. So that's the upside of change, but the other choice is to resist the change. And we think that the problem of problem people really traces back to a simple thing. When people run out of resources, when they don't adapt, when they're not flexible, they start acting out. And that acting out is what we call difficult behavior, and that's why there's more and more of it. Because as things change more rapidly, a lot of people are fighting and withdrawing from it. So here's the thing we want to start with. When dealing with difficult behavior, you always have a choice.
Actually, you have four choices. You could choose to do nothing. Now, nothing is a choice. It's critical we are consciously clear about that because suffering tends to fall in that category. And it's so easy to be in denial about the energy it's taking from you, to just allow a situation to be the way it is versus investing some energy to do something about it. But before you do anything about it, you do have to stop and say, you know, is it worth it? Is the job worth it? Is the relationship worth it? And if the answer is no,
vote with your feet. And that doesn't mean you kick the person. It means you turn around and walk away. How many of you have ever walked away from a deteriorating situation? So you know what? Sometimes that's your best choice. I've been asked when I make that choice, my answer is when it makes no sense to be there anymore. That's a great time to turn around and walk away. Live to fight another day. Come back when you have some clue of what it is you want to do instead of staying there wrestling with it and watching it deteriorate right in front of your eyes. I also think it's a great choice to make if the person you're dealing with is insane. Just walk.
Yeah, it's not
well, no, I think that's fair. And some of you are like, well, then what's the point of today's program? But here, most of the people you think are crazy aren't really crazy. They're just acting crazy, all right? There is a distinction to be made there. But nowhere in your job description does it say you must stay and suffer in the presence of a criminally insane person. Turn around and walk away. But before you vote with your feet, you have two other choices, which is what we're here to talk about today.
So one is you can change your attitude. Now, what this means is we make a mental adjustment. And all of a sudden, you can stop suffering around a person, even if they keep doing what they do. You know, I'll never forget, I met two ladies once who had the same boss who would blow up and throw the same tantrums. Now, for one of these ladies, the boss is terribly intimidating. And the other says, no big deal. Now, how is that possible? Well, I ask him on a break, so what happens to you mentally when the boss starts yelling? The one who's intimidated says she feels like a 2-year-old with her father. The one who says no big deal says she purposely visualized the boss as a 2-year-old with a dirty diaper. That image takes the edge off. Now, we will refer to this today as using your mind on purpose. But even beyond that, you have another choice.
That's right. And changing your attitude is a prerequisite to making that choice. Because if you're doing the same thing on the inside and trying to do something on the outside, your house divided against itself, and you can't stand yourself. The fourth choice is to change what you're doing, change your behavior. Now, a lot of people are like, wait a minute, I want to get them to change their behavior. Well, guess what? Your relationships with people aren't happening to you. They're happening through you. You are the point of leverage that can make the difference, but it means changing what you're doing on the inside and then changing what you're doing with them. Consider this. All of us as human beings have within us a range of behavior from our very best to our very worst. How many of you can think of people that when they're around, the best of you tends to show up? Show of hands. So just as surely as there are people that bring out your best and people that bring out your worst, it's possible for you to bring out the best in other people at their worst. It's a matter of understanding where they're coming from, understanding where you're going, and stabilizing yourself internally enough to do what it takes to get a different result from people. Now, we're not here to tell you how to change other people. You can't. And I'm guessing most of you have learned this in life, am I right? You can't change anyone but yourself. So this isn't a program about changing people. It's about accessing the better part of people. Because it's in there. And if you know how to identify it, connect to it, and bring it forth, then you get to deal with the better part of people instead of the worst part of them. Make sense to you? So there you have your four choices for dealing with people behaving badly.
So let's look at our objectives today, and then I'll tell you what our objective it is, and you can then tell us what you want to get. First of all, we want you to know you always have a choice. If you know you have a choice, then you will not feel victimized by anyone's behavior. Now, you know, even though this is what makes a relative tough to deal with, because there seems to be no choice. I mean, you don't get to choose your parents. You don't get to choose your siblings. Yeah, you choose your spouse. Technically, they're not a relative. Most of us aren't conscious. The spouse is going to come along with bonus people that you now must deal with. But if you keep in mind, you can do nothing and suffer. You could leave, get them to leave. In fact, in doing research for the Relativist book, we found that geography was the number one coping strategy. Get far enough away. But if you keep in mind, you can leave, you can change your attitude, change your behavior, then you're not going to feel victimized by anybody. You always have those choices. Second, we're going to recognize the 10 difficult behaviors. This is a no-brainer because we've not only seen them, we've all done it. Whining, negativity, attacks, tantrums, or people can be real agreeable, but you don't know where they stand, or they're totally withdrawn. It's human behavior. It is somewhat innocent. It's how people act when they're under stress. More importantly is to understand, why do people act the way they do? Why does an event occur? And one person's response is, nobody cares! That's the problem of the world today! And somebody else responds by going, fine. What's the difference? When you understand why people act the way they do, it's immediately more obvious how you need to be flexible to transform that behavior. So, even more important is that once you understand that, now you understand the strategy. Because you know what? Communication is exactly like a phone number. You need all the digits to get through. If you have a 10-digit number and you happen to turn your 6 into a 9, now that's only a 10% error, but the call does not get through. If you have all the digits perfectly accurate, but you dial the area code at the end as an afterthought, the call does not get through. Communication is equally specific. And the great news that we have for all of you today is that you already know how to communicate. You are all communication experts. We have no doubt there are more people you get results with than people that you don't. The problem is like hammering a nail. Ah! If you hit your thumb, good news, 4 fingers are fine. Bad news, sore thumb, 6 out more. How do you do it? When you recognize what you take for granted, then you can do it on purpose with those certain times and places with those certain people. So in a nutshell, our day is, first we're going to look at what are the difficult behaviors? Why do people act the way they do? Then, what do you unconsciously know about communication that you take for granted, that you are doing consistently when it's working for you? And then we're going to take that and we're going to apply it to the toughest behaviors that we face. But at this moment, let me hear from you. Why did you come here today? Are there any particular objectives you have? We want to make sure we address that. The request line is open. Yeah. Hang on 1 second. Let me just repeat for now and we'll get a mic. So you're the director of an organization, co-founder for about 20 years, and you said, unfortunately, it fell. I'm sorry.
I am the co-founder of a professional nursing organization in the state that's made over 45 regulatory changes, and we have a pretty good track record legislatively, but in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a change on our board, and we're dealing with, my perception is difficult, a few difficult individuals that it's kind of poisoned the entire board and our efforts. And I keep saying to myself, there's a psychopathology. Why and what can I do better to survive and turn this around or walk away to make things, you know, good again for the state and for the people that we're responsible.
How are they poisoning it? What behavior?
It's negativity. There's a great deal of negativity. There's temper tantrums. There is professional bullying that goes on through the internet. Attempts to professionally defame. I mean, very serious things. They're just not, you know, minor things that it's one or two people are aware of. It's involving several thousand people in the state.
All right, so you've come to the right place. The bad news is you're dealing with it. The good news is you are right there. Bullying, we'll talk about negativity. What else?
I would say the lack of public civility, just not even in professional workplace. We see it nationally, we see it locally, we see it everywhere. People aren't respectful.
Lack of civility? Can you explain that stupid comment you're making, please?
Hang on, I got
Just from how the president is treated down to we're on the local school board, we're getting ready to be pushing a levy. We know we're going to be up against it. But we also know that we're going to be treating people with respect. How do we, you know, we want to expect that same respect back. How do we help make that happen so we can get our message out positively and not deal with, as grown-ups?
Great. You know, your good news, you're in a behavioral balance with people. You shift the balance, it forces them to shift. What else?
I'll run all the way back there. Yes.
I work in a mental health setting and work with adults as clients and also parents who have difficult children. And so being able to just, you know, understand a little bit better how to engage those parents and also help other clinicians that I supervise to do the same.
You're in the right place. Anyone else? I'm coming. I actually like this. It's the only exercise I get besides lifting my bag into the overhead. Where was that hand that came up? That was you.
As a teacher, I work with many different people, from administration, colleagues, parents, down to little children. I teach first grade. And I thought maybe learning these skills would help improve not only my environment, but I could teach other people to improve theirs.
Very nice. Thank you.
Great.
Who else? Anyone? Are you guys the peanut gallery? Is that the...
The bleachers. We got someone in the middle here, third row from the back.
Okay, this will be fun. I can do it. There you go.
Hi. I'm thinking of organizations, businesses, where the viewpoints at the top may be very different than the bottom or the side, and getting them on the same page.
Hi, I'm a nurse manager of about 40 employees, and I just want to get some tools on how I can empower my staff and teach them some leadership skills as well.
We've been talking about breaking through
a client's victimology and understanding why they are where they are and finding a way to effectively reach them and break through that and empower them.
So. Awesome. We've got something for you to go. Yeah. We have some here. How about if I do this one first and I'll come up and get you, all right?
The reason I came today is to get more insight in how to deal with a difficult employee. When you point out some areas where they need improvement, their attitude is no, it's not them, it's you. I have a problem with them particularly, instead of them just correcting their performance or behavior. That's what I need help with.
Thank you. Well, so far so good. You've come to the right place. So I want you to know that we have one more. Oh, good.
I'm a lawyer, and I'm here to learn how to deal with lawyers who are there to fight instead of solve problems, and triers of fact in other counties who are sometimes mean to you.
Thank you very much. So I want you to know we're at your service on the breaks. If you would rather ask a question of us privately, you certainly can ask a question while we're presenting. Feel free to do so. But if you'd rather ask us privately, because you know who's in the seminar, you feel free to do so. We are at your service. Dr. K has to leave a bit early, about an hour before we're done, to catch a plane. So we've organized a schedule, so he'll be presenting more before then, and then I'll finish up the day with you. So here's what we have to do first. We're going to understand why do people act the way they do. And if you're going to be successful at that, you have to make a mental distinction. You need to separate personality from behavior. Personality from behavior. Now, behavior is fluid, it's constantly changing. 1 minute a person's normal, then they blow up and throw a tantrum, then they withdraw and they're quiet, then they are normal, then they're whining, and then there's something else. Behavior is changing according to two factors: context, where are we, what's going on, and relationship, who we are with. For example, consider this. Let's say you're in your work context and a person is acting a certain way. Well, you may respond completely differently if your relationship to that person is they're your boss, they're someone you consider a client or customer, they're a coworker, they're a stranger. Now consider, it's the same place, it's the same behavior, but depending on relationship, what you want may change. On the other hand, let's make the relationship the constant in the equation. Let's say you're with a spouse or someone you're committed to in that way. An issue comes up in the context of a restaurant, you may respond completely differently than if the same issue comes up at the context of your home. Same person, same issue. Suddenly, context is driving everything. So how we respond really is according to context, where are we, and relationship, who we're with. Now, human beings can only pay attention to 7, give or take, 2 things at any one time. So you could be aware of what I just said, what you think about it, the rate of breathing, temperature in the room, right foot, left index finger, and if we hear crash, something drops out. We have a part of our brainstem called our reticular activating system, and one of its many functions is radar. So if you get married, you see everyone getting married. You have children, it looks like a baby boom. Interested in a certain car, there it goes again. You ever have that experience? A part of our brain's going, and then you see it, whatever that is. All right, so coming back to personality versus behavior. If I think somebody's personality is negative, guess what I notice? Boop, boop, there they are again. Boop, boop, told you so. Boop, boop, they're always that way. In fact, you can engage in the strategy that we're going to talk about for negativity. You could be having quite an impact on this person's behavior. Maybe half the time they're negative, half the time they're not. But you know what? You won't even notice that half the time they're not. Beware, we as human beings are programmed to selectively sort our perceptions according to what we believe in the first place and get to be right about what we believe. You do not want to be right that people are difficult. That's not what you came here for. You want to be right that you can influence behavior and bring out the best in people. So personality is too big of a concept. We can't think in terms of personality. You look it up in the dictionary, it's going to say it's every aspect of a person's being, how they look, how they sound, how they act. It's everything. It's just way too big. We need to come down to where the rubber meets the road, here in Akron, and pay attention to behavior. What does this person need from me right now? Where are they acting? So, with that in mind, we want to show you the lens of understanding. Not personality typing, behavior. So we've got this greed zone, and in the green zone, we're all okay with each other, no problem. And we have four basic intents. We need to get things done. We want to get things right. We want to get along with people. We want to get appreciated by people. Now, put yourself in your own shoes. Have you ever needed to get something done? Of course. Now, think about this. What's got to happen behaviorally if we want to get things done? Well, what's going to happen is we are going to focus on the task at hand that we're trying to get done. We're going to get more assertive as we push forward to make it happen. That's behaviorally what it takes to get things done. But on the other hand, it's important to get things right. If we want to get it right, though, we're going to remain focused on task. Now we have to slow it down to make sure the details get covered. Obviously, given anything you're working on at any point in time, there's some perfect balance between these two factors that we must achieve. It's important to get along with people, is it not? Anyone have any real friends? Okay, you all do, except one of you, and you know who you are. Now, if you want to get along with people, that's, of course, who you focus on, because that's who you're getting along with. But when you want to get along, there's a tendency to get less assertive. You start putting your needs aside to make sure others are happy. You can observe this when people go to lunch. You want to go to lunch? Sure. Where would you like to go? Well, I don't know. Where do you want to go? I don't know. Are you hungry? I don't know. Are you? Now, let's think about this. Do we really not know if we're hungry? We probably could stop and figure this out. But in that moment, we're putting our own needs aside to make someone else happy. It's part of getting along. It's a little bit less assertive. It's important to be appreciated by people. Now, if you want to be appreciated by people, of course, that's who you focus on because that's where it comes from. But when you want to be appreciated, there's a tendency to get more assertive because what goes hand in hand is contribution. Ooh, ooh, have you ever gotten a place for lunch? What? You haven't? All right, everybody, let's go now. I'm not inquiring for their needs or their plans. I'm putting myself out in turn. Hopefully, I'll be appreciated. Now, depending on context, where are we? What's going on? Depending on relationship, who we're with, one of these can become a little bit more important to the other, and behavior skews off in that direction. Now, if people are not getting what they need from those around them, then their behavior changes and they go into the yellow zone. Caution. All right, let's put ourselves in our own shoes again. We need to get something done. The deadline is upon us. We are responsible for this end result. We are depending on some of our team members. We go to check on their progress, and we discover that our team members use what's called the balloon strategy of time management when you move forward on a task like this. Can you see this will stress you out a little bit? What naturally evolves out of a need to get it done is, all right, let's do this. Control. Take over. Then it happens. What if it's got to be right, but the people we depend on for information tell us, well, I don't know, it's about 50, I think. About, you think? Then we're going to go into perfection, into the details no one's paying attention to. If we want to get along, we're not sure it's happening, we go into approval, do things to make sure everything's okay between us. And if we want to be appreciated, it's not happening, we go into attention, do things to get people to notice. Now, the yellow zone, though a little bit more behaviorally extreme, is not a problem yet. But if people really get stressed out, you want to see something really scary, they turn into these people right before your very eyes. All right, that's it. I've had enough. Tank. I cannot believe what I'm seeing here. You people must be genetic mistakes. You have been working on this project for 2 weeks. You are already 4 weeks behind. Now, here's what we're going to do. Parliament dissolved. I'm in control. Any questions? Good. If you know somebody who does tank, or maybe you do it, you know you can hear tread grinding. And they got radar looking for people. Boop, boop, boop. Find someone off task. Boom! They can rip you apart personally. And the irony is, hey, it's nothing personal. Just you're in a way of end results. You have to be eliminated. Tank attack is a declaration of martial law control to produce action.
Not control for the sake of control. It's about moving things forward. Of course, control will express itself in other ways too, especially when things get suppressed. What if I resent you about something? What happened on that project last year? What if you got a promotion I think I should have gotten? No problem. When you stand up in front of your peers, I'll say stuff like, "Yeah, I got a great idea. Let's play horse. I'll be the head. You just be yourself." Ooh, don't get all emotional. Can't you take a joke? Sniping. It could be to the face. It could be behind the back. Gossip is the same category, purposely spread to cut people down. Sabotage, by definition, related to a process behind the back. The sniper doesn't get mad. They get even. Add a bunch of ego and knowledge to the recipe. Bake for 20 minutes. And watch control express itself as know-it-all behavior. That's right. I know 99%. I'm happy to tell you how much I know for hours on end. Go on and on and on at meetings. Of course, I'll never listen to your clearly inferior ideas. Now, if you compare tank behavior to know-it-all behavior, you discover very quickly that know-it-all is not as task-focused compared to somebody who's become a tank. Somebody who has become a tank is not going to waste a minute to impress you because they don't care what you think or feel. They just want to make something happen yesterday. But when people go know-it-all in your presence, all of a sudden you got ego right there on the surface, so they're going to waste all this time telling you how much they know. The problem with this behavior, unwilling to hear what others have to say. Now, take note. The fact that somebody knows a lot does not mean they're a know-it-all. The defining characteristic is unwilling to hear what others have to say. Also take note, for anyone who's done a lot of math or science, these people are not graphed accurately in the X and Y axis. If we were to graph them accurately, we'd have to put the tank somewhere out there on our assertiveness scale. But they are in their appropriate quadrants. Shifting mental gears. Let's go to get it right. Now, from get it right, I could see what could be. I look at what is. What is, does not measure up to what could be. Oh, and I feel helpless to do anything about it. That's how whining starts. Now, when people whine, they have radar like tanks. It's just a whiner radar sounds like, boop, boop. Oh, there's a problem, I told you. Pick it up, put it in my bag. Boop, oh, there's another one, put it in the bag. Oh, there's another one, put it in the bag, and the bag, it's so heavy. I can't take it, so I come to you. Here. Sign line 5. Now, when people are whining, they are feeling helpless. They're feeling the victim. It could be in relation to other people or the circumstances, or ironically, sometimes it's in relation to their own high standard of perfection, what they think should really be in this case. Other people in the face of all of that do not become helpless. Instead, they get hopeless. That's how no behavior sets in. Negativity, forget it. We tried it. Nothing ever changes. Every silver cloud has a dark lining. You try to suggest an idea to them, they say, pull, boom, got that idea. Launch another while I reload. Other people get frustrated and give up. Fine, do it your way. Don't come crying to me when it doesn't work out. And from that point on, I say, now, you hear the same nothing behavior, but out of a different motivation, because after all, a desire to get along if you don't have something nice to say. I wouldn't want to hurt your feelings, so I say. I wouldn't want you to be mad at me, so I say. On the other hand, if you want something from me, I want something from you, I want your approval. So I said, sure, okay, happy to do that. I'll volunteer. Be on that committee? Okay, Then I completely overcommit myself and things don't get done. Or consider this. What happens if I'm in that get-along mode and there's some sort of upset? Well, the part of me that says, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say it at all, keeps a lid on that upset.
it then festers and watch me go from nice yes person to your face to sniper behind the back, what we sometimes call passive aggressive. It's moving from yes face to face to sniper behind the back. Consider this. What if I'm faced with a decision that could possibly hurt somebody's feelings? You know what? Let me think about it. Tell you what. Ask me later. Maybe. And that's my final decision. Tell me something. You ever tell a salesperson you'll think about it? Were you really going to think about it? No. Approval-oriented behavior. Shifting mental gears. The need for attention grows. No problem. Nobody cares at the bottom of the day! Did you notice me? I'm tough to miss. This is grenade, the tantrum. Now, the difference between tank and grenade, the tank should be in jail, grenade should be institutionalized. So, difference is a level of intent. Somebody in a tank mode means to do it. The tank is going to take aim, but they're going to leave other useful people in office equipment standing. Whereas when people go grenade, they blow up in 360 degrees. You hear all the stuff that has nothing to do with the present circumstances. That's because tank attack is a demand for action, whereas grenade tantrum is a demand for attention. So though they're both aggressively intense, we handle them differently. What you also get out of a need for attention is another kind of sniper. This is friendly fire. This is people who like you, so they say, hey, I never forget a face, but in your case, I'll make an exception. Just kidding. It's friendly put-down humor. It's friendly gossip, not really intending to hurt anybody, but sometimes it can have some unwanted consequences. And last but not least, what we also get out of a need for attention is think they know it all behavior. Oh, yes, I'm an expert, and I believe it too, because whenever I speak, words come out my mouth, come back in both my ears, and I think, hey, this must be true. I heard it twice. These are the 10 most difficult behaviors we'll face. The bottom line is communication is like a phone number. There is a number you can dial when people get out there in that red zone, a strategy that's going to pull them back into the yellow, if not the green. But the better news we have for you is you pay closer and closer attention to what you know and take for granted in communication. You will find very often you will contain people in the green or yellow zone. A lot of times we shove people out by not paying attention to what they need from us. The red zone has gone too far. Any positive effect of a red zone behavior tends to be outweighed by all the negative side effects. For example, come with me to a meeting. Let's say we're going around and around and around, and finally I look at my watch and go, whoa, people, look at the time. We're going to have to make a decision. Why don't we just see where we stand right now? How many think it's A? Okay, how many think it's B? Wow, B, so we seem to agree. Tell you what, would you mind getting on the phone? Would you be willing to? Now, I have gone into yellow control. I have taken over this meeting. I have moved us forward. And in the way I did it, probably no big consequence and probably a good thing I did. But what if I went, I can't believe you people. Do you dress yourselves in the morning? Can you make a decision? Look, here's what we're going to do. We're doing B. You're on the phone. You're doing that. Now, that's tank. I've moved us forward. The problem is my red zone tank attack will immediately trigger red zone reactions in everyone else. Someone who's equally assertive and has similar positional power as I do may become a tank back. Oh, yeah, Rick, well, I don't think so. Somebody got tank-to-tank warfare in the middle of this meeting. Somebody who I positionally trump so they don't want to stand up to me, to my face, but really resents what I just did, becomes a saboteur behind the back. Certainly a whole bunch of people are going to go into this behavior. And after the meeting, watch them magically transform into this one. Oh, no, another meeting like that. I can't believe you missed that meeting. Let me spend 30 minutes at your desk sharing the pain so you can have it too. All these red zone reactions far outweigh the fact that mood is worse. We want to keep ourselves out of the red zone. We certainly want to pay attention to what people are needing from us and keep them out of the red. And if somebody happens to be in the red, we're going to look at it as an opportunity to develop our communication muscles. Because whenever you interact with somebody in the red zone, it's like going to the gym. Oh, good, I have to present an idea to somebody who tends to be a closed-minded know-it-all. And, oh, I got to break some bad news to a team of people who get into whining. It's an opportunity for you. Now, a couple of things to note about our lens. First of all, job function. We'll push people in a certain direction of the lens. Job function.
I did a program for an aerospace firm. They design planes, all right? So all these engineers have to be deep and get it right perfection. They don't want the planes falling out of the sky. The problem with that is you can study things from now till the cows come home and never get it done. What this organization has learned to do is they hire a very controlling manager to ride herd on the engineers, make sure the project gets done. Unfortunately, in this particular company's case, it really goes too far because management by tank attack is considered an acceptable leadership strategy and actually gets rewarded and promoted, which brings us to an organization's culture. Some organizations will allow some red zone behaviors to be and actually reward them. You know, I remember when I would do seminars for IBM as part of their leadership series. Consistently, when the IBMers looked at this, half the people in the room would go, I can't imagine somebody doing the grenade at work. And the other half would go, oh, yeah, they do. The difference was the ones who could not imagine it are IBMers who are always at IBM. The ones who said, oh, yes, they do, are IBMers who get sent to somebody else's facility. And as they got in a discussion, they realized that the corporate culture of IBM did not tolerate grenade tantrums. On the other hand, tank and know-it-all, born free. I did a seminar for a software company in Seattle, not the evil empire. They realized they had hiring practices that effectively weeded out people who needed control or attention and pulled in people like to get along and get it right at work. Now, that was not the purpose behind the way they did things. That was just a side effect of how they happened to do it. It was a big aha, aha, no wonder. We're one big happy family. Get along. And no wonder. We're very meticulous about our work. Get it right. And on the downside, aha, no wonder it's a major miracle to get a decision made in this company. Because everybody's either studying in greater detail or waiting for consensus. So, job function is going to push people in a certain direction of the lens. An organization's culture can influence where they go in the lens. And, of course, we all come in with our personal programming. And before we leave the lens, there's one more thing to note. There are three behaviors on this lens that are unique, and they will spread like the flu through a team of people. And before you know it, everybody's doing it. Go ahead. Tell me what one of them is. I know you know this. Come on. What spreads? Before you know it, everybody's doing it. Whining. That's right. Negativity will also spread. You said it's poisoning the organization. That's exactly it, because it's not isolated. Whining and negativity go through everybody. And sniping can also spread. Have you ever noticed in your work history how one department can have an ongoing sniping relationship with another department? They can be Hatfields and McCoys. Sniping, whining, and negativity are group, can be group behaviors. The others do not necessarily do that. They create problems. Like stick one know-it-all on a team of people and watch them turn them into a bunch of nothing people who give up, shut down, won't communicate at meetings, because why bother? Know-it-all so arrogant and condescending. But sniping, whining, and negativity will spread.
So here's the thing. I'd like to introduce you to a core model in our work. I think you're going to enjoy this. I'd like to have an impact on your attitude before we tell you what to do with those people. I'd like to talk about what you can do with this person, because I think that's where the game really gets played. My guess is you know all kinds of things to do with people, and the problem is once you're off balance, you can't think of any of them. So how do we get back your stability? Well, allow me to introduce you to the nature of sanity. The nature of sanity. It begins with the word assumptions, and then we're going to draw an arrow to the word behavior. Then we're going to draw an arrow from the word behavior to the word experience, and then draw another arrow from the word experience all the way back around to the word assumptions. In other words, whatever you assume to be true, you're going to act like it's true. And the way you act is going to influence people, places, and things in such a way that you're going to find proof for whatever you assume to be true. For as you believe, so shall it be. You can't help it. It's the self-fulfilling prophecy that is how our minds work in life. It's why we keep getting the same kinds of results over and over and over again. So, whatever you assume to be true. So here, this is, let me see if I can find something that I could use. Let me try this. Anybody here own a Yugo? I wouldn't admit it either, but according to Consumer Reports, it's a car that came barely assembled. It was made in the former Yugoslavia, and it had some interesting features like a door lock that works like this. When the button was up, the door was locked. That means when the button was down, the door was... That is not an easy connection to make. In fact, I know a perfectly intelligent adult human being who got trapped in a Yugo for 15 minutes. I'm not going to tell you a lot about who it was, but I'll tell you exactly how it happened. He's sitting in the car. He wants to get out and stretch. Driver's taking too long in the store, so he goes, and the door didn't open. So he did what you would do in this situation. He jiggled the lock, always ending up. Boom, boom. He starts to panic, and then he goes, calm down, there's three more doors. What trapped him in the car? Was it the door lock or the power of the human mind to draw conclusions prematurely and think it really knows what's going on when it doesn't actually have a clue? What do you think? It's that second one. That's right. For as you believe, so shall it be. Whatever you assume to be true, you act like it's true. You look for proof. You can't help it. And you know why you look for proof? So that you can win the booby prize in life, which is being right. Think about all the conflict that goes on in the world we live in today. What's it really all about? I'm right. No, I'm right. Or it's inverse. You're wrong. No, you're wrong. Everybody gets to be right. Some of you are looking at me like, what's a booby prize? So I'm going to date myself a little bit here. But when I was a little boy watching a lot of TV, and I did, the TV was about this big and a box about this big, and it flickered a lot. And there was a show on called Howdy Doody. Yeah, Howdy Doody time. Uncle Bob, Puppet, Clarabelle the Clown. And when that show first started, they used to give a prize to one of the kids in the peanut gallery where the kids sat. And then they realized that every time they gave a prize to one of the kids, that kid felt like a winner, and all the other kids immediately felt like a loser. So they came up with the idea of the booby prize, and that was the prize everybody else got. But, you know, I don't think it took the kids too long to figure out that if you get the booby prize, you are a loser. So everybody gets to be right. That's the nature of sanity. What I'm saying to you is being right is the booby prize. It's what the losers get. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't make anything better. And whatever you assume to be true, that's your point of leverage. And you may be going, well, what does all this have to do with people? So here, this is the audience participation part. If you think somebody is a jerk, how must you treat them like a... If you treat them like a jerk, how do they act whenever you're around like a... And what do you say about them? There you go. That's the nature of sanity. And by the way, I want you to think about how this is true for you with the people that you think are driving you crazy, because they're not driving you crazy. You are, with the stuff you've decided about them and that you're acting as if it's true and looking for proof. Here, let's do one more. If you think somebody is a, oh, what's the word? Moron. How will you talk to them like a... And, you might say things to them like, read my lips. And some of them will. Now, I know what you're thinking. Actually, I don't know what you're thinking. I just love saying that right there because it's so ironic. And I don't know if you know this, but irony is the foundation of humor. And you know who gets this better than anybody in the world is the British. They really get irony as a foundation of humor. In fact, I told that joke, you know, I know what you're thinking, when I was speaking in the UK, and they cracked up. They really did. They just, and what's ironic is the way they cracked up. They're like, you know, I said this, I did a program for Ford Motor Company. I had 45 plant managers all together in a room, and I told them what I just told you about jerks and morons. And a big guy stood up in the back of the room, and he goes, hold it. And I learned that discretion is the better part of valor. So I just thought they said, yes, sir. He said, I came here to learn how to deal with a guy named Joe. And believe me, Rick, it ain't no assumption on my part. Joe is a jerk and a moron. And I looked around the room and I saw 44 other people doing this. How many of you have people that will agree with you about the stuff that ties you up and holds you back and traps you into defeating yourself? You tell them, you know, that person's this and that person's that. They go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know why people are so willing to say, oh, yeah, to anything that makes you miserable? Because misery loves company, plain and simple. So here's the thing. Supposing, and I'm willing to consider this to entertain this, what if your problem person is a jerk and a moron? What if it's demonstrable and provable in a court of law? What if some of you have actually gone to court and proved it? Well, here's the thing. even if you can prove that you're right, if it's not taking you where you want to go, what's the value of it to you? That's really the whole idea here. This is the nature of sanity. Now, here's the thing. I'm not saying don't make assumptions, because I don't think that's possible. In fact, my wife brought a book home a few years ago. Some of you have probably seen this book. It was called The Four Agreements. Any of you seen that book? Show of hands? Yeah. And the first agreement, she knows what I do, and so she shows this to me with this little thing in her eye. She goes, he says, make no assumptions. What do you think about that? I said, that author is assuming I could do that, though, isn't he? Huh? Huh? See? I don't think it's possible to make no assumptions. In fact, I think our assumptions are a necessary part of how we navigate in life. For example, when you walked in this room, you didn't look at this place where you're sitting and go, what the heck is that? No, you just assumed that's probably a place to sit. You sat down, and that was the end of it. Our assumptions allow us to navigate in life, but you see, there are two kinds of assumptions. There are the limiting assumptions. Those are the ones you get to be right about, and they don't take you anywhere you want to go. Those are the ones that you get and get agreement for, and it makes you miserable and unhappy. Those are the ones that everybody might sign up for, except the person that you say is driving you crazy, but the problem is that person's still there doing what they do, and you're now stuck in this loop of self-fulfilling prophecy. That's a limiting assumption. But there's another kind of assumption. It's the useful assumption. It's the thing that you can assume that takes you somewhere you want to go, because it gives you enough informed perspective on what's going on with you and what's going on with them that you can do what actually works, what's actually effective. Does that make sense to you? This is the whole opportunity in a day like this, because, you know, Rick and I didn't come here to tell you the truth about difficult people. Well, we didn't. And maybe it's because we don't know the truth about difficult people. Or on the other hand, maybe it's because we do know the truth about difficult people, but you can't handle the truth about difficult people. But whatever it is, here's the truth. We've come here to share with you a set of useful assumptions. We're not saying people are really get it done, get it right, get along, get appreciated, like that's a fact. We're saying that when you assume that a control-seeking person is wanting to get it done, they're moving towards action, it gives you a way of meeting them where they are and engaging them to get something to happen. Does that make sense? We're not saying the person who wants to get it right, who becomes perfectionistic, we're not saying that's really what's going on with them. Maybe there are negative people. We're saying, what's the good of thinking that? The useful assumption is, oh, they want to get it right. In fact, the next time somebody's being negative, the useful assumption is, oh, get it right. Get it? Right? We're saying the person that wants to get along, who becomes so approval-seeking, is this a good time? I could come back later? No. You sure? I was wondering if on the way somewhere. Well, it doesn't have to be. I don't know why I'm even bothered. We're saying that person wants to get along. That's why they're approval-seeking. I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying that's the useful thing to assume about them, because it gives you a way of engaging them and dealing with them. And the remarkable thing about the set of assumptions that we're sharing with you this morning and this afternoon is they actually seem to work. They're tested. They're tried and true. We learned them from people like you, people who succeeded with somebody and told us, here's what to do. So a set of useful assumptions. Let me share with you just a few useful assumptions. And really, we've already begun the process of sharing this first one with you. It's called positive intent. We're saying that people do what they do for a reason they consider a good one. No matter how badly they behave, there's a reason behind it. That human behavior is purposeful at its origin. That all the things we choose to do in life, and even the things we do unconsciously, serve some function in our life, or we never would have learned to do them. So we told you four positive intents, didn't we? Get it done, get it right, get along, get appreciated. We said that's behind the tank, the sniper, the grenade, know-it-all, think they know it all, yes person, no person, maybe person, nothing person, and the whiner. That's what we're saying. That's a useful assumption, positive intent. Here's another one. People are predictable. How many of you agree with that, just at the face of it? You know, you spend a little bit of time with people, you can actually observe patterns of behavior that repeat, that are predictable. And in fact, we're going to encourage you today to do exactly that, to observe people for what's predictable. Because there's important signals in there. There's important feedback there that can guide your response if you're paying attention and noticing those signals. people are predictable, and the basic point here is that if you can predict it, you can plan for it. If you know it's going to happen, if you know in that situation that behavior is going to happen, instead of wasting your time not wanting it or thinking things about it that drive you up the wall, we're saying, hey, come up with a plan, make a strategy, and act out on your strategy, find out if it works. But doesn't refine your strategy until you get the result that you want. So that's the basic idea. Now, if you've been paying close attention this morning, some of you have already realized that what we're actually here telling you today is that you're responsible for the way your relationships with people turn out. And some of you are kind of like, you know, I don't really want that kind of responsibility. That's a lot of responsibility. I got enough on my shoulders. You know, I'd rather have it be about them. So if that's true for you, there's a name for your pain. It's called stress. And stress actually parallels the nature of sanity. It works on pretty much the same mechanism. Now, stress was originally invented by a Hungarian and Austrian physician and researcher from Canada, Dr. Hans Selye. And then he died. But before he died, he gave it a fancy scientific name. He called it the General Adaptation Syndrome. I just abbreviate that. And it works like this. It begins with the assumption that something is a threat. Once you perceive something as a threat, how must you treat it? Like a threat. And when you assume it's a threat, you act as if it's true by fighting it or withdrawing from it. And then you can point back at whatever you perceived as a threat and go, see, look what dealing with that did to me. And you get to be right. That's the nature of stress right there. And all stress is based on fighting or withdrawing from what you don't want and what you perceive as threatening. Now, I like the fact that my nervous system resists a real threat by fighting or withdrawing. I like that. I like that I don't have to think that fast in order to survive. You know, so I think it's a useful idea to make a distinction between real threats and unreal threats, things that really are dangerous and things that just seem to be. So let's see if I can offer you an example of that. How about this? You're crossing a highway on foot, and there's a truck moving in your direction. And if you and the truck continue at your current pace and trajectory, it will hit you. You will be roadkill. That is a real threat. Don't fight it. Run. And when you get to the side of the road, you're going to be a little exhausted. You'll be like, that's a lesser price to pay than standing in the path of a moving vehicle and saying, go ahead, make my day. Right? So that's a real threat. But how many of you know it doesn't take a truck for you to perceive a threat in your relationships? In fact, isn't it true that some days all it takes is for somebody to look at you a certain way? Or a certain way, and something inside of you goes, got a radar for me? We are under attack. Prepare to defend. You know, I'm just curious. Let's do a quick survey to find out how real you are willing to be with us today. How many of you go home from work exhausted on occasion? Quick show of hands. Okay, guess what that means you're doing at work. How many of you go to work exhausted on occasion? Quick show of hands. Guess what that means you're doing at home. Oh, well. How many of you are too exhausted to respond to anything we're telling you this morning? Anybody know what 100% exhaustion is called? Death. The final frontier. So we're here today to learn meaningful alternatives to killing ourselves with stress over the bad behavior of other people. And everything I've said to you and everything Rick said to you so far this morning is aimed at your attitude about how people behave. The things you tell yourself, the things that you base your behavior on. And I'd love to tell you the way out of this. How many of you would love to know, you know, I get it, I want out. How do I get out of the stress response? I'd love to tell you the way out, but I don't think you're ready yet. I'm not convinced. So I'm going to take this one step further. Yeah, because according to a woman that I greatly admire and respect, a therapist named Virginia Satir, who in the course of her lifetime helped tens of thousands of people step back from the brink of interpersonal destruction. We, the people, wherever you find us on this planet, have four ways that we resist a perceived threat. They're predictable, observable, and according to Virginia, every single one of you is gifted at least one of them. In other words, it happens automatically. You don't have to think about it. It just happens. And I'd like you to find the one you're good at. Are you game? Because I'm going to ask you to adjust your body posture into four positions and then reflect back on which one seems most familiar to you. And here's why I'm going to do that. You know, it's impossible to change a response to something in life without identifying what it is and what you do in the presence of it and what you want. If you want to break the chains of automatic reaction, it starts by taking ownership over what you're doing automatically. So with that in mind, here comes way number one. I'd like everybody to take their right hand or their left hand, and I'd like you to point it at me. Even if you perceive doing this as threatening, I'd like you to play along. Straighten out your elbow, look down the barrel of that rifle, and repeat after me. He's making me do this. That's very good. That's called blame. Blame is a stress response. It's what people do. It's like pin the tail on the donkey. You know, if it wasn't for him, if it wasn't for her, if it wasn't for them, if it wasn't for that, I'd be fine, but... That's little Steve Martin there. Excuse me. So here's the thing about blame. I heard a speaker some years ago, a fellow named Les Brown, who I believe is related to Gladys Knight of Gladys Knight and the Pips. Anyway, he was talking about blame. And he said, whenever you point the finger at something outside of yourself, you get three fingers pointing back at you. And I spent a good bit of time thinking about what that meant. Because I was like, huh? Because it is true. There are three fingers pointing back at me. But like, so what? But I figured it out. And I'm going to share with you what I figured out. Basically, what he was saying, and now I'm saying it, is that whenever you pin the tail on the donkey, you make a victim of yourself immediately. Because what you're saying is, that's the cause, and I'm the effect. And I want you to listen very carefully to this. You cannot affect change when you are the effect of what is changing. Blame is the opposite of being affected. You don't want to be the effect of what's changing. You want to be the cause of an effect. You want the three fingers pointing the other way, and you can't do that. So you want to have that be the effect of what you're doing, and that's really the fundamental shift that's possible when you change your set of assumptions and engage in behaviors that take you where you want to go. So that's the first one. Now this next one is the one that nice people do. So, and I'm looking around the room, I'm guessing there are quite a few nice people here. First of all, we're in Ohio, I grew up in Ohio, I know that there's a lot of nice people in Ohio. Am I right? Yeah. Some of you are like, really? I'm like, yeah. How do you know if you're a nice person? It's easy. People tell you. That's how you know. They say things to you like, you are so nice. So if you've never heard those words, this is probably not your stress response. But I like you to play along. Nobody needs to know. Here's what we're going to do. I like you to take your right hand and bring it palm up to receive a gift from on high. And then bring up your left palm to receive a heavier gift. Keep your hands in these relative positions. I'd like you to attempt to touch your elbows together. That should be impossible and somewhat painful, but please bear with me. Tip your head back, keeping your eyes on me. That should make it a little harder to breathe. And on the exhale, repeat after me. Oh, I am so sorry. And then shake it off. Yeah, that's what the nice people do. They're like some strange version of the Statue of Liberty. Give me your misery, yearning to be free. I'll take it on so you can be happy. It's called placating, or in Australia, placating, but whatever you call it, it's what nice people do when their button gets pushed and their chains get yanked. They take on other people's stuff. How many of you know somebody who's like a toxic dumping ground for everybody else's stuff? And they get found, by the way. People find them. In fact, blamers and placators actually hire each other. They meet and fall in love with each other. You ever walk down the hall and witnessed an interaction between a blamer and a placator? It sounds something like this. You idiot! I know! All right. All right, that brings us to our third way of resisting a perceived threat. And I'm wanting you to find the one that's most familiar to you. And some of you will be happy to hear. All you have to do on this one is sit there and get lost in thought. I'll wait here. And then those of you who have been lost in thought all morning, perhaps you could lead everyone back into the room now. How many of you ever had your brain hijack your body? and you started talking to yourself. And you don't even know what you're saying most of the time, right? Although once in a while it does rise to the level where you can actually hear what you're saying. It sounds like this. What a jerk. What a moron. And my personal favorite, I don't get paid for this kind of abuse, I can tell you that. Yeah, that, the kind of things that you say to yourself that do not help you. They do not take you anywhere you want to go. That is a stress response. And while you were out, while you were lost in thought, while you were Spock on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise with no crew, Klingons took over the whole sector. That's what I'm saying. Okay, Star Trek references, don't use them. Got it. All right, so check this out. Note to self. All right. Blaming, placating, it's called computing. It's when we get mental, basically. It's when we get mental. While we're lost in thought, the situation persists. People actually may even be getting rewarded for their bad behavior by the way people are reacting to it, and the cycle goes on and on and on. These things don't change anything but the way you are. And how many of you already found the one you're good at? Just a quick show of hands. Okay, how many of you found two of these that are quite familiar? It's all right. How many of you got all three so far? It's okay. Collect them, save them, trade them with a friend. Here's the thing. We got one to go, and this one could make a mess, so please be careful. But what I'd like you to do is take your right hand and point it over your left shoulder. And then bring your left hand up under your right arm and point toward the ceiling. And then balancing your notes on your lap, I'd like you to cross your right leg over your left leg. I'd like you to turn your right foot to the right and your left foot to the left. And then turn your body to the left and your head to the right. But your eyes to the left. And then offer to help someone. It's called distracting, and it's what we do when we don't want to deal with something. You know what I'm talking about. Something's going on, you don't want to deal with it, you throw yourself headfirst into anything else. I mean, literally anything else. But the problem is, because you're not being discerning, the thing you threw yourself into, you don't really want to deal with that either. So you throw yourself into anything else, and before you know it, you're in a house of cards and the smallest little breeze, and the whole thing comes crumbling down around you, and you're exhausted. These are the four ways that Virginia Satir identified human beings all over the world doing when their buttons get pushed and their chains get yanked. And hopefully you found one or two of these that are very familiar to you. Because if you have, you're in just the right place to begin to make a real change in your life with us today. And you know, we didn't come here just to have fun. We came here to have an impact. We know you're dealing with difficult situations and difficult people. Here's where it truly begins, your point of leverage, where what you do can make a phenomenal difference in your relationship starting today, off into the future. And I call the process I'm about to share with you breaking the chain of reaction. Because we're talking about automatic behavior, and we're now bringing it into our awareness so we can influence ourselves in order to influence other people. I'm now going to tell you the way out of stress. And the way out of stress is a pretty simple thing. It's called having a direction. It's called having a direction. The way, think about it. All stress is based on fighting or withdrawing from what you don't want. So the way out is to aim for something. What do you want? Now, you know what? In every kind of work that Rick and I have done over the years, whether it's doctoring or speaking or training, we've found that people always know what they don't want. Everybody knows what they don't want. First question a doctor's taught to ask a patient is, what's wrong? What's your chief complaint? Everybody knows. It's something else entirely to say what you do want. And I learned the value of this years ago, back in the early 1970s. I worked in a scrap iron and steel recycling business in northern Kentucky. And to show you how much the world can change in 40 years, in those days, we just called that a junkyard. Anyway, I shared an office with a guy who was completely predictable. You could set your watch by him. Any of you know somebody like this? I always knew what time it was. I didn't need a clock. 12 o'clock on the dot, the door at the bottom of the stairs would open. I'd hear these labored footsteps coming up the stairwell. It always sounded like that. Guy would arrive at the top of the landing, cross the office, sit down behind his desk, reach underneath it, pull out a lunchbox, set it on his desk blotter in the same place he'd been putting it for the last 15 years. I know this is true because I looked at his desk blotter when he wasn't there, and there was a lunch pail-sized indentation. Some of you are like, what's a desk blotter? But I'm telling you, they used to have them. Anyway, And then he would double-click the lid on his lunch pail, and he'd pull out a sandwich, and he'd unwrap that sandwich, and he was peeling a banana, and make a face at his food. And he did this every single day. He'd go, and then he'd look over at me and tell me what it was, as if I wanted to know. He'd go, peanut butter again, Rick, and then he'd eat it. And this happened every single day. It's peanut butter again, Rick, and he'd eat it. It's peanut butter again, Rick. You know, after 2 months, he'd had all the peanut butter I could take. Have you ever felt that way? I decided to get involved. I said, hey, Dave, here's an idea. If you don't like those sandwiches, why don't you ask your wife to make you something else? He goes, my wife, I make these. I learned something that day. I want you to learn it today, which is that if all you know is what you don't want, you will get more of it. And that explains a lot right there. And what I'm saying is the way out is to say what you do want. And there's two sides to what you want, because there's your side and there's their side. And here's how you know it's what you really want. You're willing to commit to it. That's how you know it's what you really want, not what you wish, but what you want. You're willing to commit to it. You're willing to say, you know what? I'm going to get this result with that person. This will happen. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I'm going to keep coming back and adapting and being flexible until I get this result. That's when you know you've got a desired outcome, not just a wishful thinking outcome. You know, when I was a kid watching that little TV box inside of the great big box, there was a show on called The Honeymooners. It's actually one of my favorite shows when I was a kid. And Ralph Cramden and Ed Norton were the names of the two characters. And Ed worked in the sewers. Ralph drove a bus. And Ed said something about commitment that I've never forgotten, and I'm going to share it with you now. It really makes the point. This is what he said. He said, as we say in the sewer, if you're not prepared to go all the way, don't put your boots on in the first place. So what I'm saying to you is if you're not willing to commit to a different result with someone, at the minimum, commit to a different response to them inside of you. At the minimum. When that happens, what do I want from me? What's the best of me when they do that thing they predictably do? Make sense to you? I'm going to tell you right now what I think you want from you. You want your composure. You want to be able to calm yourself down. I'm going to tell you really quickly three ways you can get there. Way number one, 10 minutes a day, you do what I'm about to tell you to do, your stability in life will guaranteed increase. But not only that, your memory will improve. How many of you would do, no matter what I tell you, you would do it for 10 minutes just to get, if you could remember, you would do it for 10 minutes a day. Your concentration will improve. The world could go crazy around you. You don't have to go crazy with it. Not only that, if you've got high blood pressure, it'll bring it down a few points. It'll improve your nervous system. Your digestive system will work better. Your immune system will work better. That's a lot of benefits for doing something that I have not yet told you about for 10 minutes a day. And for those of you still holding out on me, it'll slow the aging process. Is everybody on board? Here it is, 10 minutes a day of doing nothing. Now, some of you are like, I'm way ahead of you on that, Rick, so let me explain. Nothing but the one thing necessary to keep you alive in this moment. Anybody know what that's called? Breathing. Here, breathe in right now. Just breathe in, let it go. That's powerful. That's how you break that stress cycle, is you learn to breathe in and let go. And if you just do that for 10 minutes a day, one guy said, can I do it when I'm sleeping? I'm like, no. I'm a fan of napping, but that's something entirely different. This is doing it, this thing that happens anyway, but paying attention to it, doing it on purpose. How many of you spend 10 minutes a day in traffic? Perfect environment to practice your 10 minutes a day of breathing to get your stability back. I'll tell you two more things you can do. You can change your thoughts. Change what you're saying to yourself. Say something to yourself that encourages instead of discourages you. Like my friend Max, 83-year-old guy, was unable to make ends meet on his fixed income, took a part-time job in a fast food restaurant to supplement his income. When he told me he was going to do that, I was like, oh, are you kidding me? That just seems so wrong. He's like, when you've lived as long as I have, you roll with life's punches. So I went to show up at his workplace, that fast food place, on his first day of work to offer moral support to my friend. He was like, Rick, I got to work. I'm like, oh, man, that didn't even cross my mind. He's such a nice guy. He says, listen, I'm going to take a break in a few minutes. I'll come over and talk to you. Just sit at that table over by the door. So I went and sat by the table over by the door, and I watched as this huge punk walks into this fast food place. I mean, this one scary-looking dude. This guy's earrings had tattoos. This guy, huge guy, and he was unhappy with his Happy Meal. And of all the people he could express his displeasure to, who did he target? This 83-year-old guy named Max. And I mean, he was in his face, shaking his fist at him, jabbing his finger at him, and cussing up a storm. And I got to tell you, I'm sitting at this table over here, and part of me wants to rush to my friend's defense. Any of you ever felt that way? Part of me wanted to get between him and tell that guy, you, back off. Most of me remained seated, wishing that my wife was with me because she's a martial artist. But at any rate, Max didn't need my help and he didn't need my wife's help. He had this totally under control. Now, this is what I saw him do. No matter what horrible thing that guy said to him, Max nodded his head as if he completely understood. No matter what horrible thing that guy, Max was like, and guess what? The guy ran out of rotten things to say at some point. He used them all up. And now he's just standing there staring at Max, and Max said these words, thank you, young man, for being honest with me about how you feel. And that freaked that guy out. He backs out of the restaurant looking very paranoid. Max comes over, sits down with me. He's cool as a cucumber. I am shaken, not stirred. I go, how did you stay that calm? He says, well, Rick, I just told myself that young man was doing the best he could with the limited resources he had on board. That's what I mean by change your thoughts. You get the power of that? You're standing there in this withering attack, and that's the way you're talking to yourself. It changes things. You can also change your point of view, get your perspective back. My father taught me this. You know, it took me 6 cars to learn how to drive. That's how I got into the scrap iron and steel recycling business. I had an affinity for it. And it was my dad's fault because it took him 6 cars to learn how to help me learn how to drive. I will never forget that 6th time when I called home from the scene of the accident. Yeah. I remember what I said. I said, Dad, this hurts me more than it hurts you. I was driving down the road minding my own business and somebody wrecked your car. And on the other end of the line, my father did something brand new. He breathed. Everybody breathe in. Let it go. And then he said, Rick, is anyone hurt? Can you hear what he did right there? He said, what's more important, human life or scrap metal? I misunderstood, thought it meant I was going to be. But then I heard him breathe again. Come on, one more. Just breathe in, let go. And then he said, 100 years from now, what difference will it make? Now, do you think he was saying that to me or to himself out loud? What do you think? He was saying that to himself out loud. Afterward, he felt compelled to say a number of things to me. But my father had finally learned his lesson. I love saying that. In fact, when my dad turned 80, we threw a surprise party for him in Cincinnati. It wasn't that big of a surprise. We didn't want to kill him. Anyway, but they asked me to do a toast. I got up and I told that story, and I got to look at my dad and say, well, Dad, 20 more years, we'll know. He just turned 90, so I guess we will know. That's all I'm saying. All right. So that's what I call getting your perspective back. How many would trade a finger or an eyeball to not deal with that person ever again? Okay, most people are kind of like, you know, well, every once in a while, you're like, I would make the trade. Most people are like, you know what, I'm going to keep the finger, I'm going to keep the eyeball, I'm going to learn how to deal with that person. It's not that bad. That's what I mean by perspective. That's how we break the chains of reaction. I hope you'll take that process home and think it all the way through. In fact, you might even want to talk to somebody that you were talking to today over the next few weeks. Rick, it's all yours.
So the overall strategy here is, know what you want in any situation. You identify what you want. As a humanoid life form, you'll be more quickly aware of what I don't want. I don't want to be angry. I don't want to be upset. As soon as you identify that, then your next step simply is, okay, if I don't want to be upset, what do I want? I want to let this go. I don't want them to misunderstand. Okay, I want them to get that. What you want is definitely going to be affected by context and relationship. We could be in the context of a business meeting. Somebody acts out, and we may just want to get this meeting back on track. And then after the fact, we may now have a new goal to discuss this inappropriate behavior in the meeting context. So relationship and context will be big. We're going to pay attention. In fact, what you're going to walk out of here, what I call is a conscious communicator. And a conscious communicator is paying attention to the cause-effect relationship between what you do and what you get. You can consider people to be musical instruments. We play them with our behavior. If you pay attention to what's working, then you know how to be flexible with other people. And in fact, the beauty of this is you already know how to communicate and you have a zillion opportunities to practice. Of all the things that we could focus on that's going to have such an impact on the quality of your life, you hardly have to make time for this subject because you already know how to do it and it's around you all the time. The limitation is your 7 bits of attention. So the name of the game is to get your 7 bits of conscious attention focused on what you know. And like anything you do, you put a little bit of conscious attention on it, and before you know it, it becomes automatic. So in weeks to a month, some of the behaviors that today may drive you crazy will be no-brainers for you. They won't even show up as a bogey on your radar because you'll know what the strategy is and what to do, and you'll just automatically do it without even thinking about it.